was your position as basically towards the other people?
It's difficult. It can be lonely. But, there's sometimes a little bit of infighting, as it were. Whether it it's up to you as the base leader to try and smooth over any personality clashes. Yes, you'd get personality clashes sometimes. We did in the first year. I had a personality clash with somebody. I wasn't base leader at the time. But in the end, we learnt to have a modus vivendi, and we were reasonably friendly. I mean, we had a week or two where we were really at each other's throats, but after that, we realised that it couldn't go on like that. So we agreed to sort of waive our differences and live in a civilised manner for the rest of the year.
A whole week at each other's throats.
Well, maybe longer.
Longer.
Mm. But you have to sink your differences and learn to live together. Because if in a closed society like that, living in the same hut and with only six of you there, you can't really afford to let these things fester on and on and on. Otherwise, something serious might result. And anyway, why make your own lives a misery for a long time if so you sink your differences.
But how's your position? How's our decisions being taken?
Oh, decisions.
Are problems being solved?
We didn't have people more or less did their own thing. Most people down there are the sort of people you get down there are, most of them are self-motivated. So they will be doing things. They don't have to be told. If you go to the Antarctic, the sort of person that goes to the Antarctic does things without being told. So they're all doing things. They're all doing their job. They're all doing this and that. You have a system. I mean, for instance, the system was... or part of the system. I've told you that we had three or four meteorological people. Then you have to have somebody who is the cook. I mean, you don't want to go down there and have lousy food all the time. So we used to take it. One person would be the cook for the week. So then we had, as I said, a storeman. Now, he was in charge of all the food stores. We had a huge room. And that was the food stores for, say, a year and a half. Everything for a year and a half would be in there. So if the ship didn't get down in time at the end of the year, you still carried on. And so he would be the quartermaster or storeman. And he would issue the cook with a week's supply. Just next to the kitchen, there was a large cupboard. And he would issue the cook with a week's supplies. Every week, and so that man was excused virtually all other duties for the week. He would be the cook, and you learnt to produce good meals, and but that was one of the most demanding and hardest tasks on there. I mean, people wanted breakfast and they wanted lunch and they wanted a good evening meal, and sometimes tea in the afternoon as well. Three or four sittings a day you had to cook for, and for tea in the hour, I mean, they would expect bread as good as you have in Europe, and buns and cakes and things like that. So I mean, most people learned to make good bread, good buns, good cakes and trifles and things like this, and although it was tinned meat and tinned this and dried that, you could learn to use it in a creative manner. And we ate fairly well, I would think. Yes, we ate fairly well. And most people took their cook's duties seriously and, you know, did a pretty good job. But I can remember one chap who shall be nameless. He was there the year before me. Now, when he was, he hated cooking. He was a funny character anyway, and a real, really eccentric, or an oddball. And for instance, when you got issued your stores for being cook at the beginning of the week, you would have so many tins of different kinds of meat, and so many tins of different kinds of vegetables, all that. Now, to have hot water, of course, it's a large kitchen, and we had an Essie stove in it, an Essie Dura stove, and it's all run on anthracite, and it had three or four ovens in it, all at different temperatures. And they had a thermometer on the front of each oven, so you knew what the temperature was. And so the one on the top right was the hot oven, and the one on the bottom left was always cooler, and this, that, and the other. And a great big hot plate on top of the stove, covered by a big, thick cover to keep the heat in when you're not using it. And piped into the back of it is by the side of it, and standing higher than it, is about a tank of, say, nearly 100 gallons size. Do you know gallons?
Must be more than a litre.
Oh, yes. 8 pints in a gallon. So 8 pints in a gallon, and it's about nearly 2 pints in a litre.
So 4 litres a gallon?
4 litres to a gallon, yes. Something like 4 litres to a gallon. So you're talking about a tank of 400 litres? Mm-hmm. Something like that. Bit less than 400 litres. Big tank. And to get... The only way you could get hot water, or any water in some of the times when it's freezing, is to melt snow. So that was one person's duties. He would have the duty every day of cutting snow blocks and bringing them inside and putting them in this tank. You take the lid off this copper tank, you see, and put in your snow blocks. And it was full of hot water because it was piped from the stove at the back. So you would have 100 gallons there, 400 litres of sometimes water that was nearly boiling all the time. And then you'd have another tank for cold water. And, of course, bringing it into the kitchen, I mean, putting it in the tank, it automatically warmed up and melted into water. So you had your two tanks, and so you had constant hot and cold water. It's quite civilised, really. And this chap that I was telling you about previously, he would get the tins of meat, and now he would tie strings on all the tins of vegetables that needed to be heated, and all the tins of meat that needed to be heated. And these tapes were about 2 metres long, these strings, 2 metres long, 2.5. And he would then get all the tins. And on the end of every piece of string, he would write Monday lunch, Tuesday breakfast, Wednesday supper, and all. So each can would have so many cans for Monday lunch, so many cans for Monday dinner, so all through the week. And he would then get all these cans and throw them in the tank of hot water. So they would stay in there. And the strings would hang. He'd put the lid on. The strings would hang in the gap over the top of the lid and hang down the side of the tank. And then when it came to Tuesday lunchtime, he would just go through all these strings. And when a label said Tuesday lunch, he'd pull it out with the tin on the end, and you'd pull about four or five tins out for Tuesday lunchtime and open them and put them on plates on the table, and that was it. That was his cooking. He put them in the hot water tank. And, I mean, by the end of the week, say Saturday or Sunday, the stuff you were eating had been in the tank since Monday. And he just used to pull out the strings all day, and that was his way of serving up things. Quite imaginative, really. Really, really eccentric. But shall we say, it wasn't appreciated by the people that had to eat it. He was one of the less good cooks. Mm-hmm. Uh, There are other stories about him, but I don't think I'd better tell you. This program is it going to go out? I mean, English people might hear it one day, mightn't they?
Could be.
Yes.
I don't know.
In case he's got any living relations, I won't tell you. Well, I haven't told you his name anyway, If I told you the story, they would recognise who he was. So I won't tell you any more stories about him. But that one's good enough.
Anyway, what I originally asked you was about the decision process.
The decision process. You're a good interviewer. You don't forget the points. The decision process. As I said, most people down there are what they call self-starters. They do things by themselves. We had a... Amongst the four meteorological people there, we had what you call a senior met man, a senior meteorological person there. And he would be in overall charge of the meteorological and the weather observation of the whole thing. Now, if something needed doing on that side, he would be in charge of it, and he would organise it. See, that was his speciality with the other Met people there, and he would decide what to do and that sort of thing.
Of course, everybody has a specialty, but this closed community, of course, like a ship where the captain is the leader.
Yes.
Is the base leader like the captain?
The base leader is like the captain on the ship, yes, definitely.
So
yes.
His will is law.
His will is law, oh yes. But I mean, by the same... His will is law, that's right. If he decides that something's got to be done, then it has to be done. But by the same token, you don't go throwing your will about all the time. You let people, providing they're not upsetting everybody and providing they're not affecting safety and providing they're not... upsetting matters and providing it's okay, you don't stop people doing things, but sometimes you will see things that need to be doing and nobody else has noticed it, or because they're not the base leader, they don't notice it or think about it. It's the same all through life. If you're responsible for something and you're the chief and you're the leader and you've got the responsibility, you see things that other people don't. If you see something that needs doing that nobody, you are in overall responsibility, I mean, you would say, well, you would tell somebody to do something, or you would ask them to do something. You can see me, I don't throw my weight around. You'd go out to somebody and say, well, look, tomorrow, do you think we could do that? And perhaps you would go with them and you'd do it, or send them out, or we need to... As I say, most things happen. We need to paint this room or do something to the base. We need to repair this. You find that people were so self-motivated that they would think of it at the same time as you would, and they would already be thinking that they were going to repair it tomorrow or next week or whatever. So there wasn't a lot to do. But sometimes you would notice something. And you'd do it. You took the ultimate responsibility. My form of... it's difficult. You didn't lead a lot by telling people what to do. You lead by example and let them see what you're doing. I remember once we had a dog down there that was... we'd inherited from an Argentinian base. She'd come over. We shouldn't have really had her. When the government of the Falkland Islands found that we'd had her, they didn't like it because, they've got rabies in Argentina. So, and there was a possibility, they thought, that this dog would have rabies, but we knew that she had been down in Antarctica for years and on various Antarctic ships. But, at one time she became very ill, and she needed some injections. And we went over to the Chilean base and got some antibiotics. And because of, I suppose, because of my past experience in biology, or I had been in the Royal Army Medical Corps, actually, for 2 years in the British Army. I mean, I was the one that had to shave the dog down and find out the right place and give it the injections, you see. We did this for about a week, and she fully recovered. And then again, she got amongst one of our other dogs, and she became pregnant. She was a lovely dog, and she became pregnant, and one night she started to have these puppies, again in the radio room, after we rebuilt it all. She had these puppies underneath the radio operator's desk, and somebody had to stay up all night with her and take the puppies and kill them all. Because, I mean, you just can't have a lot of... I mean, we had six dogs. That was two pets and four huskies. You can't feed any more dogs in the Antarctic or on Deception Island. So, I mean, there was nothing for it. They had to be destroyed. Well, I mean, that job came down to me. I remember staying up all night. They were the most wonderful puppies I've ever seen, and took these little things as they came out one at a time, and take them down to the sea and kill them. I went down, spent all night running up and down to the sea and getting rid of these poor little puppies. We had a man that was, as I say, we had a man in charge of the stores. He did that. We had the man in charge of the cooking. We had a man in charge of the dock. Now, he was also the senior meteorologist, meteorological man. He was also in charge of the dogs. But that was because he wanted to be in charge of the dogs. He undertook the job, and that's fine. He volunteered, that was fine. But, I mean, we would always give him a hand with feeding the dogs or hunting for food. Now, we had the husky dogs, and we didn't have enough pemmican for them. I mean, the pemmican that you had to feed them with was just for an emergency. To feed your dogs, you had to... they all had pedigrees, and they were all their names and their titles and their antecedents. You know, the mother and father and all that sort of thing were all logged in on sheets, just like a pedigree dog would be here. And so you had to keep the dog records, and... you have to feed them, most important, and look after them. And so you were expected... We had rifles and ammunition, and you were expected to hunt seal to feed your dogs. And so we all used to give a hand with that. But, I mean, that is the most distasteful thing. I think even worse than destroying the puppies... was hunting the seals, because seals, I don't know whether you've ever lived with seals, but I'd seen a lot of them on South Georgia earlier on in a previous time, and they're wonderful creatures, and they have no fear of you, and they're absolutely, they trust, well, not always, but I mean, they have wonderful eyes, and just, it became worse, you'd think. You become hardened to hunting seals. But I don't... I think, in fact, I know as far as myself was, it became worse as time went on to have to shoot these seals. And Deception Island doesn't have many seals. I mean, there were times of the year when we were down to practically nothing and had to use our dog pemmican. And so every seal sometimes at certain times of the year, if you'd see a seal a couple of miles away, I mean, you'd have to go after it. And I must say, I didn't enjoy... I used to do a lot of the seal hunting because nobody... there's only one or two people liked it. And well, I can remember when I shot the last seal I ever shot, I felt I couldn't shoot another one. But you have to, because your dogs would die. So... you have to keep doing it. I mean, I could shoot a seal and gut it. I could get the alimentary tract right out from its mouth to its anus in seconds, all in one piece. Yeah. Gutting it, I don't mind. I mean, once it's dead, it's dead. You can't do anything more. And, I used to be able to gut them very, very quickly. Then you have to tow it all back to your... all back to base. I mean, you might shoot it a mile away or half a mile away from where the base is, of course. And then you have to get it back. I remember once we shot a seal. We were so desperate. And the dogs might have been started to starve and everything. We saw a seal swimming out in the sea. And we went out to it in a boat. And they said, "What's the point in shooting it in the water?" I said, "Come on, we'll go out." And we went out and we shot it in the water. And, of course, we put grappling hooks on it and towed it into the shore on the boat. Yes, on this little rowing boat. We had a small... Do you know the seagull outboard motor? We had small seagull outboard motors on the backs of the boat. They looked just like a petrol tank on a stick. And... yes, we shot it and we took these grappling irons and fixed them on it and towed it back to shore. And we got it. It was quite successful. They thought we couldn't do that, but we did it. And, of course, you only feed the dogs. We only fed the dogs every 2 days because dog digestion is very slow and you give them a huge block of seal meat. We had a large wooden area called the plan, because on whaling, on the whalers and sealers, where you cut the whales and the seals up, where you cut the whales out, it's known, the Norwegians, it's known as the plan. And we had our little plan there, and we used to have the seals on there, and you'd chop them up into cubes, or roughly the same size pieces, and you would give one piece to one dog every 2 days. So, and that was all they had to eat, and they lived on that. I mean, they were quite healthy on that. So they would be, you gave them the meat and the blubber and everything. And we once took a Mr. Clements, known as Clem. He once took a, he skinned a seal carefully and very well and took a nice large seal skin off and made a coat out of it. He did all the tanning and the, he made it into good leather and made a lovely sealskin coat, all down on the base.
Did you also shoot penguin?
No, you wouldn't shoot them. We killed them occasionally just to eat. Yes, we would kill penguins to eat. The only part that you can eat of a penguin is the breast. We used to eat penguin breast, yes. Now, as far as eating wild things, when we killed the seals for the dogs, we used to take the liver and the kidneys out for ourselves, and occasionally the heart. But the liver and kidneys, certainly, you would take out and take that back to base, and that was fresh food. It was excellent. Excellent liver and kidneys. And occasionally we would kill penguins and have penguin breasts, but not very often. They're quite nice. They're all right, yeah. Nothing wrong with them, eating them. But people didn't like killing penguins very much.
That's the seals.
Yeah, well, you killed the seals because you had to keep your dogs alive. You didn't have to kill penguins because we had food already. So, yes, I don't know whether it's less than seals. Killing anything like that I don't like. I like it even less now than I did in those days. What we used to do was have penguins' eggs. About a couple of miles away, you had to climb up, say, 1,000 feet above sea level. Don't forget, our base was at sea level, you see. Climb up 1,000 feet and go over a mountain ridge and down the other side of the island. And on the out, what I call the outside of the crater rim, and there was a penguin rookery. I think, my memory fails me here, but I think they were ringed penguins. Anyway, this penguin rookery, I would think, I mean, there was something like perhaps a quarter of a million birds there. I mean, there were a lot of huge penguin rookery, densely packed with all these penguins. So every spring, we used to observe this, and when they started to lay their eggs, we used to go over with rucksacks, and we would pitch a camp over there, a tent, and sort of, you would have people rotating over there. I mean, you'd go over there and you'd live and you'd sleep, and we'd keep coming back with sackfuls, rucksackfuls of penguin eggs, and because they will lay more eggs if you take the eggs soon after they've laid them. Providing you leave one there, they will lay more eggs, so it doesn't do any harm. And yes, we used to get hundreds of penguin eggs and bring them back, and we had a special wax. So you could dip them in, I forget whether we heated it, anyway, it was runny liquid, I think you heated it, and you dip the penguin eggs in the wax, which gave them an airtight coating. And with the airtight coating, you could keep them fresh for months, maybe 6 months, something like that, maybe even longer, 6 months anyway, because the air is totally excluded, and the temperature down there is very cool, very cold. So, I mean, I said even inside the base, the seawater froze up, so it shows you how cold it was even inside. I mean, that would be in the kitchen. You would have the old fire, and you'd be lovely and warm in the kitchen, and you'd go out into the corridor, and I mean, it was like going out in the corridor was like going out into the actual outside weather, because there was no heating there at all. And as I say, these great big tubs of seawater froze, and it has to be very cold for seawater to freeze, and this was indoors. And I can remember in our bunk room where we used to sleep, sometimes you would have half an inch of ice on the inside of the windows for weeks. For instance, on a Saturday, now you take a Saturday, we used to do all the chores. All the floors would be cleaned and swept, and the place would be tidied up and cleaned, you see, on a Saturday. Well, sometimes you couldn't wash the floors for weeks and weeks, because if you wash the floors with water, they would freeze immediately. The water would freeze on the floor before you could dry it. So you'd all go sliding round the floor. And also, when you got a blizzard, a high wind, the whole of the floor was covered in, most of the area was covered in lino. Do you know lino? Linoleum. Mm. Sort of floor, plastic sort of flooring. So, the wind would blow under the floor, and the flooring would blow up. I mean, there would be, you'd see bubbles rippling across the floor where the wind was going on and blowing the flooring up, because it's an impervious coating, you see, not like a carpet. And some impervious smooth coating, like plastic, and it would blow up and down with the wind. Do you want to stop? It's the phone. My daughter's answering. So it would blow up and down with the wind, and as I say, some days for weeks on end you couldn't clean it, because if you washed the floor, it would just freeze solid, soap bubbles and everything. But anyway, we'd get these penguin eggs, and they made wonderful omelettes, and I mean, they're about three times the size of a hen's egg. They're right.
Yeah.
Three times the size of a hen's egg, maybe four times. And we were eating, one person in the end, I mean, you'd be eating triple penguin egg omelettes. So, I mean, you'd be eating the equivalent of 10 hen's eggs at one time, one person at one time. Wonderful omelettes, these penguin eggs, absolutely wonderful. And as I say, we used to have our little camp over there while they were laying the eggs, and the tent would stand there permanently, and if somebody had got a spare time, they would go over there, gather up the penguin's eggs, sleep in the tent, next morning they'd come back. You had to do it all on skis. You couldn't do it on them. You couldn't do it on foot, it was too dangerous. So you do it all on skis, so they bridged the crevasses.
My mum needs a word with you.
Yeah. Okay. For a minute?
Yes, okay.
Ah! Mum needs a word.
Yes.
Daughter. What were we talking about?
Penguins omelettes.
Yes. Oh, yes, penguin egg omelettes. Well, they were delicious. Absolutely haute cuisine. They were. Absolutely haute cuisine.
But actually, I wanted to ask you something else, but because you said that you were leading a base through by example.
Well, yeah.
Which sounds almost priestly.
Almost priestly is a very dramatic term. Anybody that does any kind of leadership must be prepared to do the equal or more than those he's trying to lead. Don't you agree? Mm-hmm. If you take the army or the navy or the forces or anything, one of the first preoccupations of anybody in charge of another group of people is to look after the interests and the welfare of that group of people, even before your own welfare, very often. I don't think priests can abrogate this idea for themselves. You see it in all walks of life. You see it in the forces. You see it in many forms of leadership. Unfortunately, you don't seem to see it very much in politics. But yes, you've got to be prepared to... Anyway, I was brought up with that idea anyway.
Mm.
Mm. But one doesn't think of oneself as a priest.
No, maybe not, no. You know, about this difference between Scott and Shackleton, Scott the Navy man, Shackleton the civilian.
Yes.
The difference in appreciation that you find for Scott
and Shackleton. Well now, surprisingly enough, I didn't know Scott or Shackleton. And a lot of things have been written about Scott, many of which I've read, but I don't know. If you read one book, it will say one thing, and if you read another book, it will say the other. And appreciations of Scott, or of anybody in the past, varies with the decade in which these appreciations are written. A book about Scott in the 30s wouldn't be the same as a book about Scott in the 60s or the 70s. So I don't know about Scott. One can look at his preparations and his dispositions and his logistics, and one can find a lot of faults in that. He should have succeeded, but he didn't. Well, yeah, he didn't. That's all I can say, really. He came from a different background than, say, Amundsen. I mean, Amundsen, I suppose, had the benefit of being a Scandinavian, more acquainted with mountains and snow and icy conditions. And they happened to choose the use of dogs. Which was excellent. Dogs for polar exploration are superb, and you can handle dog teams. They can do fantastic things. FIDS, as you possibly know from other interviews and your researches, FIDS and BASS up to now, have always had dogs down south on the bases, and they've done a lot of excellent work. I mean, they've learned from Scott that that was not the way to do it. But, of course, I mean, he even took tractors. Well, he was in advance of his time because, I mean, nowadays, the day of the tractor in Antarctica has come back. But unfortunately, Scott's tractors were not quite big, good enough. I mean, let's face it, they're pretty primitive. Whereas nowadays, a modern snowcat and skidoos and all kinds of modern mechanical snow transport is very reliable and very useful. You may also know that owing to the terms of a recent Antarctic agreement, dogs are having to be phased out of the Antarctic area.
Yeah.
I've already told you that we had to hunt seal to feed our dogs. So I'm in two minds over this. Deception Island had a very poor seal population, and the only ones that came there during some time... I mean, sometimes of the year there'd be quite a lot, but at other times of the year they were only visiting seals. Now, you couldn't shoot enough seals sort of when there were a lot of seals there in the summer, for instance, because they would go bad. I mean, you only shot so many seals and you just couldn't keep them hanging about forever. So the rest of the year, when the seals were really away, you only had visiting seals. And, of course, as soon as they appeared, you shot them, which is terrible. I mean, that's partly why I didn't like it. and perhaps we were affecting the seal population of Deception Island, because the seal population of Deception Island was very low. So you could say that ecologically it's bad to keep dogs there, although on the other hand, on a base where there's loads of seals, I don't think it does much harm, because even with your dogs, I mean, if there's a lot of seals there, you're not affecting the population greatly. But as for, I mean, I don't think that is the reason that this recent agreement has come to pass. I think they think that the dogs might be introducing diseases into the Antarctic.
Yeah, viruses.
And viruses and things like that. There's two things against that. Our dogs that belong to Bass have remained in the Antarctic since the 1940s and 50s. I mean, they've been bred and bred down there all the time. So they're not going to be introducing any new diseases or viruses into the Antarctic, because we're not getting them from somewhere else in the world now and taking them down there. So they've been bred in those conditions all the time. Now, you might say that the other thing is, of course, well, they might have already introduced them. But if they have introduced them into the Antarctic, these in the areas of Bass and Fids, the organisms or whatever are already there. I mean, we've had 40 or 50 years of dogs down there. So if we kill them off now, the organisms have already been introduced.
Yeah, it's a little too late.
It's too late. Yes, it's too late.
Sledges have already been there.
Yes, everything's... That's right, and now we kill the dogs off.
Has been done.
Did yes.
you learn sledging over there?
Yes, yes. We didn't do a lot of sledging. We were a small island and we didn't have any... We needed to travel about it. And we needed to go to the summit of the mountains occasionally for surveying. But we did it mostly by man-hauling. So we only had four dogs. We used to harness them up occasionally and a sledge just to learn about doing it, really. I mean, we had mountains of books about it all, and we were always talking to our other colleagues on the radio about them. Journeys, but on Deception Island you didn't need long sledge journeys and all that, but We still kept our sledge dog harness up, and we learnt how to make, well, there wasn't much there actually. We actually did make a lot of sledge dog harness and booties, and we used to make all our own harness, yes. And we did have a go at it, just for our own amusement, really.
So you didn't go on a long sledge?
Yes, no. Well, you can't on Deception Island.
Do you regret that?
There are other compensations, yes, in a way. Yes, in a way I regret. Put it this way.
The compensations?
Yes, there were compensations. We did a lot more boating. We did have Deception Island was known as the social centre of the Antarctic, because there was boats coming in for the Chilean base and ships coming in from the Argentinian base and ships coming in from our base, and we used to all mix up. I mean, that is not really one's image of Antarctica. But on the other hand, you were totally isolated for 6 months of the year when no boats came in. So, I mean, I can remember a time when Deception Island was surrounded by solid ice for 200 miles in every direction. Well, right across to the Antarctic mainland in one direction, and 200 miles to the north or something like that. So, I mean, and it lasted for months and months and months and, nearly a year. So, I mean, you were isolated. There's no doubt about that. And we did travel. I mean, we walked to another island once, but we didn't take the dogs. We went across to a small island just in the sea there. But of course, we had no reason. We weren't a survivor. You only travel if you have a reason in Antarctica or anywhere. I never travel anywhere without a reason, even if it's only to meet you from the station. You see, but those that needed to travel were the ones that were doing surveying and map making. So, although they used to take meteorologists with them, I mean, you might have one or two surveyors and two sort of assistants from who would be meteorologists or something like that. But you needed to have a party of four, perhaps, or three, or whatever you decided on. For safety, perhaps, you needed three or four people. So we had no reason to travel, even when the sea was frozen and we could have walked across to the Antarctic continent. What was the point? We had no reason to go out there and do that. And in the Antarctic, you don't just go swanning around for fun, really, because it's too dangerous. And the consequences could be too great. But if there's a reason, like map making, or it's your job to do that, then you do it. Now, we used to go around our own island, but as I say, we had one or two sledges, one particular, I remember, and we used to tow it around the island, man-hauling, three or four people, which I enjoyed. I enjoyed doing that. I can remember once we were doing telerometer surveys. Has anybody spoken about telerometer surveys to you? A telerometer is a device, it's a radio device, and just stop it a minute. What about, when are you got to go?
Yeah, I have to leave the place at 5 o'clock.
Leave here
at
5? Supposing I ran you down, do you want to stay longer? I mean, seems to me we've hardly started.
I have to get this plane.
Yes, I know, but I was wondering if I ran you down to Gatwick.
Let me think. Does that, how long does that take you?
Well, it'll take me 2 hours, an hour down there and an hour back. Actually, if I've got to go up to Norfolk tonight. Okay, well, you've got to leave this house at 5.
Yeah.
Okay. We just carry on a bit then. Telerometers. Telerometer is a radio device for measuring distance. Now, as you possibly know, maps have always been made since time immemorial, since surveying really became a science and an art. by triangulation. You have a baseline of known length, and you draw triangles around it, and then triangles on those triangles from fixed points, from trigonometrical points, with theodolites and all been doing it very accurately and all this sort of thing. But you you have to go where and set up points, and then go to known points and observe those points from the known points, from two known points along a baseline. Are you familiar with all this? But anyway, that is so. With theodolites and triangulation. Yes, and I mean, that is how you do it. And you also do running traverses and things like that. Well, with the telerometer and radio measurement of distance, you can do it by trilateration as well as triangulation. So we had telerometers down there in the 50s, and so you would go to the top of a mountain with your radio transmitter, and you could, and somebody else would go to the top of another mountain or a prominent point, top of a mountain usually, I mean they're the most prominent points, and sit there with his reflector or something, and you would bounce your radio waves backwards and forwards, and you'd get an instant reading of the distance without having to travel all the way in between. So your parties could be dropped by helicopter. Now, the helicopters came off HMS Protector, the Falkland Islands guardship, and they would drop us in various places around, and you'd be able to measure the distance between all these places very quickly, far quicker than travelling around and doing it. Then you'd get very accurate measurement of distance. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that was quite advanced in those days. That was the 50s. We were doing it. It's like radar, really. So, we were doing that in those days. And so when the surveyors were out and about on different islands or on the mainland, they would need us to go about our island and make points for them to focus the radio waves on, you see. Or they would need to come. So we would support these people in the field all the time while the telerometer survey was going. I mean, we would have to go up Mount Kirkwood and sort of set up a camp there, and while somebody was going up another mountain on the mainland, and you'd sit there until he'd bounced his radio waves off you. I mean, it might take 2 or 3 days, but due to the weather and various things. Of course, unless you can actually see it, it's sometimes difficult to actually focus the telerometer exactly in the right sector. And so we were involved in going round all the time and doing this sort of thing. I can remember once we were asked to put something that could be seen visually on top of Mount Pond from on Deception Island, from I think it was from the mainland. And we filled a large red, I've told you about these hydrogen filled balloons, we filled a huge red hydrogen balloon up and took it 2,000 feet up this mountain. It's several miles away. And one of the things I always remember about that, there is, we had somebody there that was perhaps a little irresponsible. And when we got to the summit, near to the summit of Mount Pond, we were going over a large expanse of ice and snow. And we were roped together, just in case, because there are funny crevasses around there, because there are hot underground heat areas, because remember, it is volcanic, the island. And I was first on the rope, he was in the middle, and somebody else was bringing up the rear, or he was at the rear, I don't know. Anyway, at some time, without telling anybody else, he took himself off the rope, and I didn't know. And all of a sudden, he was catching me up. I looked round and I saw him catching me up. I thought, my God, you know, I could have gone down. He could have gone down. Very, very irresponsible. But anyway, we put this huge balloon up there, and they managed to see it from the Antarctic mainland. But my goodness me, even 2,000 feet, it is very cold. Well, it was very windy too, very cold and windy on the top of a mountain. you think there's no wind, and when you come to the top, all of a sudden it's sweeping up the other side. You get tremendous foam effects on the wind there. I can remember going up a small mountain on Deception, and I could not get to the top of it. It was only about 700 feet high, 700 or 800 feet high. I forget what it was called. I've climbed it, I must have climbed it 30 or 40 or 50 times. And this day I went up there, and there was a fair wind. And when I came within perhaps 100 feet of the top, what are we talking about? 50 metres or something of the top. The wind was increasing with every half a metre. You could measure the difference in the wind. And in the end, I got so far, I was being blown off the mountain. I could not go any further. I was just being blown off the mountain, and had I lost my footing, I would have just gone skittering down. I mean, the wind was so... I have never known such a wind. And it was fantastic. I mean, it must have been well over 100 miles an hour. You just couldn't face it. And every foot, every half metre or something like that, it was getting faster and faster. And in the end, I had to lie down. I knew I couldn't get to the top. I had to lie down and just crawl back down. And you could feel it as you went down. Every metre again, the wind was getting less and less and less. Amazing.
I'd like to run through your through the notes that you made.
We've done a lot.
Yeah?
We've done a lot, yes. See, yes, that leadership bit. Another thing, you asked about the leadership. You've got to remember that a lot of the people down there, I mean, I was appointed the leader, but a lot of people down there could have done that, could have also been leader. And I think perhaps if you're a leader, you ought to be also capable of being a follower. And I would have been just as happy to be a follower or a leader. I mean, we had several people on our base who could have equally been the leader. As I say, you get self-motivated people down there. You don't go to the Antarctic unless you're... unless you've got these qualities, maybe. I don't know.
No, that's exactly why I asked you, because you didn't come as a leader. You were suddenly appointed from outside. And
yes.
That's quite interesting, because... a way of getting a leader which is quite different from the way that normally runs in society.
Yes. I don't know how else they would have done it. Have you spoken to more leaders, have you?
No.
Interesting. Well, that was how it happened. And it's not easy. I mean, the people that go to the Antarctic, there's a lot of them are strong characters, strong personalities. Not easy, not easy. But you don't wallow in it, you just... anyway, I don't know what to say about it. I did think of something to say. Oh, yes, now, you know I mentioned just now... of this friend of mine detached himself from the rope, which I didn't think much of. A few months later, or a few weeks later, I can't remember now, we were doing the same thing on the flanks of Mount Kirkwood. We had been up there to do this part of this telerometer survey, and we were bringing the camp back down. With a telerometer, I mean, it sounds all nice. You take up a little radio set. But, I mean, in those days, the radio sets were quite big. You have to have a largish dish aerial, radar aerial, a dish, flying saucer, and then your radio set. And you also have to take a motor. I mean, you have to have a generator up there, a petrol-driven generator engine, and a generator to make electricity to run it all, because he just couldn't take batteries. So, I mean, there's quite a lot to running. I mean, you had a really good big sledge full. So you got your motor and your radio and your aerial and all your own food and stores and enough to live up there for a week. Perhaps if the weather clamps down, you see, you might have to stay up there a week to get the job done. And we were bringing all this down from Mount Kirkwood at one time. And a friend of mine, Bill, William is often known as, I've forgotten his surname at the moment. We were all sort of milling around on this snow ridge, getting things organised to take it down the final sort of 1,100 feet. Because I'm talking about feet all the time. You need to talk in metres, don't you? 350 metres or something like that, 300 metres. And getting things organised. And all of a sudden, we all looked round. Where was Bill? And he had fallen down a crevasse. There was a tiny hole in the snow had opened up underneath him. It's only about a half a metre wide. He'd just gone down this hole into a crevasse. And we came cautiously to the edge and looked down, and there was Bill standing on a little ledge. Luckily, a little ice edge had stuck out. And he had gone straight down and landed on this small ice edge. And there he was standing. He didn't dare to move or anything like that. And so, I mean, it can happen. We were unroped at the time. None of us were roped up. We'd taken the risk. And he had paid the price. Well, we got him out. I mean, after a few photographs of Bill down there, we got him out. I mean, you had to... Well, luckily we had ice axes with us and plenty of nylon ropes, and we lowered a rope to him with prusset loops and managed to get his feet in one each, and then we belayed them round the ice axes at the top, and every time he lifted his right foot, we drew on the right rope and belayed it round the ice axe, and then he lifted his left foot and we belayed it round the other ice axe, and we got him out. Four ice axes, I think, we used. But, I mean, luckily we were, there were four or five of us there to do it. If he'd been there by himself, he'd have gone down. But I never used to go by myself, unroped, over that sort of ground, without being on skis. Skis will, you can do a lot on skis. I mean, they transfer the weight in an even manner from the, over, say, over a 6 foot length. So, I mean, the bridge over a crevasse tends not to break away. And but yeah, so I mean, he fell down there. We got him out. It took us about, I don't know, half an hour maybe. I've met him since, up in London at an annual reunion. And so it can happen. The other thing on Deception Island was the definitive geology of the time was done while I was on Deception, while I was base leader. So we had a young lad down here, very good geologist, I think from Birmingham University, and he came down and we supported him in the field all over Deception Island for, I don't know, 5 months, we say, during most of the summer. And which means we lent him a man from our base who stayed with him all the time, and he covered the whole island inch by inch doing the geology and loads of samples, 100 tons of boxes of stone and samples and things, and packed it all up, and we sent it all back to Birmingham University. And now I didn't go, I'm not a great one for Antarctic reunions, I've only been to about for Bass and Fidds reunions. And I'm also in the Antarctic Club, and I've been to about three of those. And one year, anyway, I turned up at the Antarctic, the British Antarctic Club, the Antarctic Club in London for the big dinner and everything, you know, with the Duke of Edinburgh was there and all kinds of people. And they have a seating plan. You look at the seating plan and you see all these people, you see, and there was, I was seated next to a professor. And it said, Professor Hawkes, Birmingham University. I mean, there he was, an old man of, I suppose he was in his 40s then, or yes, in his 40s. And this was the young Don Hawkes that we had supported in the field. And I hadn't seen him from that Antarctic summer till I met him up in London there. And he was a full-blown professor then and in charge of the whole Department of Geology at Birmingham University.
It was going to the notes, I think.
Oh, yes. Well, I don't know. We've covered a lot of it. We should never cover all of it. I can remember one of our chaps took his bagpipes. He was a Scot. And the very first time I ever went to Deception Island, he took a set of bagpipes with him. You know bagpipes? Yes. And the first moment I arrived on Deception Island, he was walking along a ridge some distance from the base hut, playing these bagpipes, and it's all sounding round Whalers Bay and everything. It's quite interesting. I don't know.
Were there any other music things?
Music? Mm-hmm. Oh, music. Yes, we had... I'm not good at talking from these notes. We had, we were generally fairly musical. Most of us were pretty keen on music. And we had a sort of primitive radiogram down there that we used to play a lot of, a turntable and amplifier and speakers. And, yeah, we used to listen to a lot of music. I mean... I listened to a lot of Beethoven down there. Learned every note of several Beethoven symphonies. So I can remember it now. Now, what was it? Beethoven's Third, the Eroica. We certainly had that. And it was by conducted by Eric Kleiber. Eric Kleiber, yes. And I think... it was the Concertgebouw Orchestra of Amsterdam. And I think that was one of the records we played on and on and on. But I never got tired of it. I could play it. I love the Eroica. I mean, I've got two or three versions of the Eroica now. And well, we had quite a bit of Beethoven, some Mozart. And I can remember once... when a ship came down in the summer, it brought a copy of somebody with a copy of My Fair Lady, which was the latest musical of the time in London. And of course, I mean, it gets into one's soul, and we were all going around singing songs from My Fair Lady. But yes, we used to play quite a lot of music. I would say more classical than or musicals than anything other. Cards. There were people that played cards. I didn't particularly fancy cards, but I mean, sometimes you would have a card school that would start, and they would start playing cards in the evening and go all the way round till sort of 5 o'clock in the morning. 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning, playing cards all night. Then they would sleep all day, and you'd they would be sleeping by day and being up all night. Because in the winter it gets very dark, and you get almost constant darkness, and it's easy to do that.
And how did you spend your spare time? How did you spend your Sundays?
Yes. Well, Sundays... I don't think we took a lot of notice of Sundays, of what day of the week it was. But free, I mean, you were no more free on Sundays than you were on Mondays or any other day. I mean, Oh no, we more or less abolished the weekends. Every day was the same, except for Christmas Day. Free time, though. We had free time. You weren't always working. You did when the weather was suitable. You did a lot of skiing, as I said before. Some people went fishing. Oh, that was another source of fresh food. You could fish, and I didn't do that. But I remember Paisley, the man I mentioned before. He did quite a lot of fishing and used to bring fish back to the base, which we used to eat. Excellent it was too. I used to eat it, but I didn't used to fish for it. We did a bit of target practice occasionally, but not a lot. Skiing was the main thing. Boating, well, you see, photography. Yes, we had a darkroom, which we rigged up, and we'd do quite a lot of photography. So, and we had the facilities for doing our own developing and printing. And a lot of people used to do that. I used to do quite a lot of that, developing and printing and doing a lot of photography, some of which is still yet to see the light of day. The films are developed. I've got the negatives, but they've never been printed.
Was there any kind of religious service?
No. No, I would say we were... let's put it this way. There wasn't a lot of outward sign of religion amongst us, but religion wasn't talked about much. I was religious at the time, not very religious. I mean, I believed in God at the time. But we didn't do much about it. I think one of us was a Roman Catholic. But no, I can't say that religion played a big outward sign in our lives. Although it may, of course, one never knows what part it was playing inwardly to somebody. They might have been drawing strength from it. I wouldn't know, really, but we didn't have any official service or anything like that.
You wouldn't know?
I wouldn't know what?
From other people.
So, well, on our base, I mean, amongst six or seven of us, I wouldn't know. No, there was no outward sign of religious observance. But as I say, inwardly, they might have been people might have been drawing strength from their religion. I think we were multi-religious. I don't think everybody was the same religion. As I say, I don't even know. Discussion of religion didn't play a large part in our lives. I wouldn't have thought. I didn't think no.
You yourself were religious. How did you consider this landscape where no man lived?
I considered it absolutely wonderful. I'd love to go back. I sometimes think if I was a millionaire, if I had plenty of money, I would get a small ocean-going boat and go down there myself. Again. I loved it, the landscape, the scenery, the atmosphere, the ambience. I loved Antarctica, but I can't go back anymore because I'm not rich enough. But I don't think I would like to go back as a tourist. No, I wouldn't like to go back as a tourist.
Can you imagine Scott saying, "My God, this is an awful place"?
Oh, yes. Yes, he was strongly religious, and I can well imagine it. It is an awful place sometimes. I mean, I've been to several deserts too, and I mean, they're very similar to the Antarctic. Places are either awful or not awful according to one's own outlook, and also according to what's happening at the time. I mean, if you are... benighted or marooned on a mountain at night in a blizzard and you have no idea where the base is or how to get off the mountain and you're going to freeze to death, I could well imagine anybody saying, my God, this is an awful place. Absolutely. Especially in Antarctica, where there's absolutely nothing. I was on South Georgia for a time earlier on, and I visited Shackleton's grave there. He's buried on South Georgia. Now, he was a leader, you see. He brought all his men through and achieved a lot in the way of survival through tremendous odds. I think that what he achieved was little short of miraculous. I've never read anything like it. And when they were travelling across South Georgia in the last parts of their journey, they said they felt there was another person with them. Some kind of religious feeling they had. Have you read about Shackleton? Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes, they said they felt as if there was a presence with them. I've been to the whaling station on South Georgia where they finally came out and seen the mountains down which they came. Yes. Fantastic. And I was glad to have seen Shackleton's grave. Mind you, have you read about Douglas Mawson, the Australian explorer? Antarctic explorer. I mean, he did. He also did tremendous feats of survival.
Mawson.
Yes, Douglas Mawson. If you get your chance, read up about Douglas Mawson. Yes. I can remember when I first came to South Georgia, I was dropped off by the Shackleton, which was a Fidge ship. I was dropped off on South Georgia and left with the whalers. Left on King Edward Point. That's right, I think it was King Edward, or was it King George? Something. Anyway, I don't know, I better not say. I was dropped off in the little British base there. I think a chap called Bob Spivey was the leader and the resident magistrate. And he said to me, well, he said, they've dropped you off here. You've got to wait for a ship and you're going to be here several weeks and all this sort of thing. He said, we've got nowhere for you to sleep. He said, but we've got the jail. And there was a jailhouse with two bunks, no heating, no nothing. It's a jailhouse with one room with two bunks. And he said, there's another chap living in it. But he said, you can share it with him. I mean, it's a tiddly little place. I mean, it's not as big as this room here. I mean, I suppose it was about perhaps 10 foot by 10 foot, something like that, or even less, maybe only 9 foot by 9 foot, 3 metres by 3 metres. And I went in there, and you probably don't know this, during the 40s and 50s on British radio, what we call the wireless, there was a programme called Dick Barton, Special Agent. Very exciting, every night. And his companions, Jock and Snowy, and they were always saving the country from spies and wars and bandits, and, you know, very exciting. Dick Barton, Special Agent, and it had wonderful rousing music to it, which I believe came from Orpheus in the Underworld. Anyway, he was a great commanding man who played this on radio, called Duncan Cass. Great big beard, tall, brown, bronzed, weather-beaten face and all that. And blow me if I walk into this jail on South Georgia and it is Duncan Cass in there sleeping in the jail. He was also a surveyor as well as an actor, and he'd been down running a survey for the British government on South Georgia and making maps of the area. And he was living in the jail, and one of my heroes of my youth. There he was, living in the jail. So I met Duncan Cass. I've seen him on television several times since. Yes. So there you are. You have to go to South Georgia to meet people. Well, I don't know about you. We ought to be packing up.
Yeah.
There's a lot more if you've got the time, we can arrange another meeting.
Then I have to go to England again.
Oh, is this your last trip?
Yeah, I'm going to Gatwick.
No, but I mean, are you coming, you know, next month, next week, any other time?
Mm-hmm.